Hi folks, hope all is well. This is Jim Carl, welcoming you to a special series of Banter podcasts recorded at the Web Summit in Lisbon earlier this month. Bruce Pavitt will always be associated with a Sub Pop label. He was one of the co-founders of the hugely influential Seattle grunge label in the 1980s, and he joined us to talk about the label's genesis, Nirvana, record labels today, and his involvement with new tech play 8stem. Please excuse the background noise on this podcast. The Banter stage at Web Summit was located in the main hall, and there was a lot of hubbub behind it.
Hi folks, welcome back to the Banter stage here at Web Summit. First of all, big thanks to all the dudes, to Ricardo, to Cesar, and to Josh for all the help getting this stage together. This stage was sort of shone on them a little bit earlier on, and they've coped mightily with it. So my final interview today is with this gentleman here. This gentleman is Bruce Pavitt. Welcome, Bruce. Welcome to Banter.
Hey, Jim. Thank you.
You were involved with the establishment of Sub Pop. So what I'm curious about is, what exactly are you doing in Lisbon? Why are you in Lisbon this week?
I'm in Lisbon to help promote a new interactive music platform called 8stem, number 8 stem, that allows for effortless remixing on your cell phone. So what we're doing is we're allowing music fans to participate in co-creating music with the original artists. Those remixes will then get posted on Spotify or Apple, thereby generating revenue for the artist and for 8stem.
Okay, so what's the royalty split in terms of like being 8stem and the artist?
That is
That's a very good question.
That's a very good question, Jim. And we're still formulating that, but I will say rough ballpark would be 70% for the artist, 15% for 8stem, then 15% for the gatekeeping company, Dubset, that will be scanning the material, making sure there's no copyright infringement. So those are ballpark figures, yeah. But that's the general zone.
Right, so that's a pretty good take for the original content creator. Then, like, where did your interest and where did your involvement with 8stem come from?
I was inspired by my close friend Adam Farish. We both lived together on Orcas Island, which is an island that's a couple hours north of Seattle. And he presented the concept to me a few years ago. He showed me a prototype. And I was very impressed with what he was doing. And so we've gathered a small staff based around that concept. And we have an office in Seattle, Broadway and Pike on Capitol Hill. The project just got... has just become available in the App Store.
I look forward to anyone who's this is Banter podcast as well, checking it out, because I mean it sounds like something that it definitely needs to be used. You said that 8stem is headquartered in Seattle. You were involved with Sub Pop, which is always the kind of associated with Seattle. But you're not from Seattle. You're originally from Chicago, right?
I'm originally from an hour south of Chicago, Park Forest, Illinois. And I was very much inspired by the punk rock scene that was happening in Chicago. So I used to take the train up to the city and hang out at Wax Trax Records, a store that eventually founded a label that introduced a lot of industrial music to the world. And when I was 21, I moved to Olympia, Washington, where I started the Sub Pop radio show on Chaos FM and started the Sub Pop fanzine, which is the roots of the label.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about Olympia. You know, I mean, you've said in interviews before that Olympia was sort of the birthplace of this particular ethos, this punk rock ethos, this DIY ethos. What attracted you to Olympia in the first place? What was the fact that Chaos was there, or was it for other reasons you went to Olympia?
Olympia is home to the Evergreen State College, which was one of the very few state-funded alternative schools in the country. A lot of famous alumni, including Matt Groening, who started The Simpsons, for example. Kerry Brownstein, who is now in Portlandia, etc. So it's been a breeding ground for independent thinkers ever since the mid-70s. And the Chaos Radio was situated on the Evergreen campus. Chaos Radio was the first station in America to prioritize independent record labels. 80% of everything that got played on Chaos had to be on a small label. And because of that, Chaos had a very deep catalog of indie punk records, and it was from that catalog I kind of got my real education. That's where I started my zine. That's how Sub Pop got started. It was with the kind of the networking information I gleaned from the records at the station.
Okay. So what did you go to the Evergreen in the first place to study, Bruce?
Punk rock.
was there a course in punk rock?
Let me just say that there was open to independent study. So I joke about that, but that's really the core of what I was studying was independent record labels.
So you were going through, like, I mean, the records that were in the record library and the radio station. You were also kind of, like, I mean, doing this Sub Pop zine as well. Like, what was, I suppose, I'm curious about, like, I mean, you're there in Olympia. You're living there. You're checking out all this music. You're forming your own ideas about what's going on. Were there people who are influential in terms of, like, sending your thinking in a certain way?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
Were there people, as well as records, and as well as kind of like, I suppose, zines, were there also people in this indie Olympia scene who were influential in kind of like, I suppose, fine-tuning your thinking?
Absolutely. There's a gentleman named John Foster who is the music programmer there. He set up the independent label policy. He also started a publication called Op Magazine, OP, which reviewed exclusively independent recordings. They started with the letter A and they ended at Z. So it was a cross-genre magazine. Any artist that began with A was covered in the magazine. It was very influential at the time. And I would say John was my primary influence, was my mentor.
Right. Like, the thing is, like, you're talking there about independent records and independent labels, and I'm fairly sure everyone in the audience is probably going, like, yeah, we accept the way the indie thinking is right now. Back then, in the 1980s, was there a different take on independent labels? Were they given the same level of respect and the same understanding?
Absolutely not. The revolutionary idea that a community radio station should play records made by people from the community was actually very novel and completely radical at the time. Even then, there were a number of DJs, for example, that just wanted to play Grateful Dead for 2 hours, which they weren't able to do because the Grateful Dead were on Warner Brothers, and they were very frustrated. It was definitely a revolutionary concept. But I specifically saw that the independent record was the most radical concept that was coming out of punk rock culture. Even though a lot of the punk rock records were on major labels, you were seeing more and more indie singles coming out of regional scenes. And what fascinated me more than anything was that every city in America was releasing these DIY singles. A lot of them were not getting any kind of media attention, and that's why I started my fanzine. And I reviewed records region by region so you could flip through and you could see what was going on in Milwaukee, what was going on in Chicago, what was going on in Austin. And nobody was doing that at the time.
I'm also curious about, like, the fact that there was all these strong regional scenes, like you say, like what was going on down in Austin, what was going on in Seattle. But it strikes me that the means of distribution was quite limited back then as well. Had ADA started at this stage? What was going on in that score?
Very good questions.
Thank you very much.
Distribution was extremely limited. There were essentially three distributors in the United States. Two were based in San Francisco, Systematic and Rough Trade from the UK.
Jeff Travis.
And then there was one in New York called Gem. There was a network of indie record stores across America that would gamble on these DIY records. But it was very, very primitive network, and I worked diligently throughout the 80s to help promote that network and help build it up so that by the time Sub Pop really started kicking in 1988 or so, that network was it was more mature, it was more developed, there were more stores or more stations or more publications, and I think that really laid the groundwork for the success of Nevermind, which came out in 91.
Because it struck me, I've had a conversation on IM with a friend of mine, and we're talking about that there's an interview recently by Ahoni, and he was kicking back against Spotify and all that. And it strikes me that, like, it's just as important to get the means of distribution right as the means of production to allow everyone access to that.
Absolutely, and I totally agree with you. And the distribution was very primitive at the time, which is why I always included the mailing addresses of these records in my zine because a lot of them weren't even carried in the stores. So they're very, very hard to find.
Okay, so let's fast forward a little bit then, Bruce. You know, you've got your show going on, you've got your zine going on as well. Like, at what stage did you kind of meet up with Jonathan? At what stage did things kind of take a turn towards record labels and kind of Sub Pop 100?
Okay, in 83, I moved to Seattle. I continued to put out cassette compilations of music. So Sub Pop was actually distributing collections of music from around the country in cassette form. In 1986, I released a vinyl version of those comps called Sub Pop 100. I did that myself. I noticed that there was a specific sound coming out of Seattle, which later was referred to as grunge. And I released a record by a group called Green River that featured members went on to form Mudhoney and Pearl Jam. After I did that, I was introduced to Jonathan Poneman, and we decided to work together. We released a Soundgarden record, and in 88, we opened up our first office with $20,000, which we spent in a month, and we spent 3 years desperately trying not to go bankrupt.
Okay, those initial times, you mentioned very influential bands there. You're talking about Soundgarden, you're talking about Green River. I'm curious about the sound of that particular scene. How quickly did it become apparent to yourselves that there was a specific sound coming out of Seattle and it was something that needed to be documented?
In 1986, there was a compilation called Deep Six that came out that featured a lot of these groups. When I heard that compilation, it became very obvious to me that there was a distinctive regional sound. And that's when Sub Pop shifted from doing trans-regional compilations, you know, groups featured from around the country. We decided to focus specifically on Seattle and specifically on these groups. There was a local producer, Jack Andino, who was recording this stuff. There was a local photographer named Charles Peterson. When I saw his photos, I knew that if I combined Charles's photos with Jack Andino's production, there would be kind of a singular aesthetic that we could present to the world, a very focused aesthetic that I felt that people would relate to, and they did.
And that aesthetic, I mean, that still holds true today. You know, I mean, I remember talking to Clint Friedman, the photographer, about that. And he identified that particular aesthetic that was coming out of Seattle in the late 80s as really influential. Were you taking your reading on that aesthetic? Were you taking your, I suppose, understanding on that images from other labels? What other labels at that stage were having an impact on your thinking?
I would say UK labels like Factory and 4AD had their packaging was much more sophisticated, but they had a unified aesthetic. We took the idea of having a unified aesthetic, but the music was much rawer, and it was a lot grittier. It wasn't as sophisticated, but that was part of its charm.
Both those labels you mentioned there, Factory and 4AD, they had kind of like, let's be kind, they had mad mavericks running them. You had Tony Wilson, you had Ivo Watts. Wilson.
Oh, yeah.
Did you model yourself in either of them?
Not exactly, but I was very influenced by those labels, and I thought they were brilliant.
Okay. Let's fast forward then into kind of like the Sub Pop life story to Nirvana, you know. And I'm curious. Can you remember? Obviously, because you've written about this and you published books about the photography of Nirvana. Can you recall what your first encounter with them was like? Like, I mean, what were they like then? And did you know instantly there was something there?
I was first introduced to Kurt Cobain about a year before I heard his music. He was introduced to me as a roadie for the Melvins. And I went over to his apartment, and he had a lot of pets. I remember he had a pet rat, and there were a lot of rock posters in the room, Rolling Stones and Queen. And it was an interesting hang, but it didn't occur to me at that time that this guy was a genius and that it was going to become the world's most popular rock star. Fast forward a year later, we heard the Nirvana demo. I thought his voice sounded incredible. We set up a showcase. They played. The material wasn't that good, but again, his voice really came through. The most amazing thing about Nirvana and Kurt Cobain is their rapid growth and development. They went from essentially a sort of mediocre band with a good singer to creating incredible songs with incredible performances in a matter of 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, I'm curious about that because, I mean, that's a holy grail for many labels, finding an act that you can actually develop and actually track the trajectory of the band's growth. Like, you said that songwriting got better. Was that down to, like, was that down to confidence? Was that down to changes in personnel, maybe? Or what was it down to, do you think?
That's a good question. I don't really know. I do know that their live performance improved tremendously, and I think very specifically that had to do with them watching Mudhoney, because Mudhoney were very physically expressive when they were on stage, and that very much inspired Kurt and the group to be much more expressive on stage. As far as the miracle of Kurt's genius songwriting development, I really don't know. But it's absolutely fascinating.
Right, it's fascinating because, I mean, then obviously Sub Pop released Bleach, and you got a great quote about Bleach. You said that you spent $600 on Bleach and it sold 2 or 3 million copies, and therefore, ergo, it's the most successful record ever released.
I think it might be the most profitable record in history. Yes,
it's unbelievable. I mean, it probably is. Like, so $600. When they went into studio, did you reckon they were going to come out with a kind of a whopper of an album? What were you expecting once you kind of, like, I suppose, booked the studio, gave them the $600? This budget, what were you expecting back?
We were expecting a reasonably good record, but again, at the time, their songwriting wasn't that great. And even though I think Bleach has a couple of good tunes on there, Jack and Dino's production really did a great job of capturing the energy of the band. The record really connected with a lot of people. We sold about 40,000 copies. But in retrospect, I don't think his songwriting was really that strong.
Yeah.
And just reflecting on the $600, Sub Pop was so broke we had to borrow the $600 from the band.
From the band? So the band paid for their own fucking record?
They did, yeah. That's how broke we were.
Okay, so you were also so broke as well that you were bouncing checks left, right, and center.
You're not supposed to ask me about that.
Oh, that was one of the issues I go nowhere near.
No, that you could write a whole movie around the bounce checks alone, yeah.
But, like, also, you know, going back to what you were saying earlier on, I remember this from a previous interview you did. You were talking about, like, I mean, you know, the rudimentary distribution chain that was there. Is it true that, like, I mean, you were kept going basically in terms of UPS delivering checks from record stores who were selling your material around the country?
Yeah, so one thing, we did a couple things that were a little unusual. We started selling COD direct to stores. Stores were willing to do that because we would do limited edition pressings of some of our records. And if stores purchased our records directly, they would get some of these limited edition recordings. So we were kind of incentivizing them to send us cash directly. Otherwise, you were dependent on distributors who were supposed to pay you after 90 days, and oftentimes they wouldn't pay you for 6 months. Sometimes they would go out of business, you wouldn't get paid. There was absolutely no way we would have been able to stay in business unless we did direct retail. So that was actually pretty radical. In addition to that, we created a Sub Pop Singles Club, whereby fans would send us money in advance for records that hadn't even been made yet. And that was a very radical business model.
Well, I mean, that was, in many ways, that was the forerunner of Kickstarter.
Yes. Yes, it was. Yeah. I remember little things that kind of kept us afloat. This is a little-known anecdote, but when the movie finally gets made, I'm sure this character will be in there. But the local bank had a bank teller named Matt, and he was a local mod, and he appreciated what we did. So we'd come in with these checks, and they were mostly out-of-state checks, and typically they'd have to put a 7-day hold on them, and he would cash us out. So again, it's all about cash flow. Checks come in, we get the cash immediately. Even if we had to wait those 7 days for the checks to turn around, it could have meant the end of the business. So all those little things made a huge difference.
Okay, shout out to Matt for doing
shout
that.
Shout out to Matt. I owe you a beer, yeah.
Okay, so but obviously then once Nirvana got into a situation where Geffen came on board, you know, with Nevermind, suddenly Sub Pop was in play. You know, you were getting approaches from labels. There was this kind of like grunge gold rush. People want to kind of sign more acts from Seattle, and they also kind of want to do a bit more business with yourself and Jonathan. Am I right?
I'm sorry.
They also want you to do more business with yourself and Jonathan after Nirvana were a proven success story.
Well, Yeah, they did. They wanted to come in and steal our bands, is what you're saying.
Yeah, and in a nice way, I'm saying.
Yeah, but you know, usually get a check for that, so that kind of worked.
The other thing as well, though, like Bruce was that given the fact that suddenly majors were interested in signing grunge bands, did it become harder for Sub Pop to kind of like sign bands cheaper? Was the kind of the advances you had to pay for acts, were they kind of going up because of all the interest from other labels?
Yes, that's true. What would typically happen is we would discover a band, we'd offer them $5,000, major label would come in and offer them $100,000. And then we would have to compete with that, which was very challenging. So the success of Nevermind, in some ways, really was very damaging to the independent music culture because the majors stepped in and realized there was a gold rush, and they also realized that these indie labels were savvy, and all they had to do was wait on the side, watch the indie label make the deal, okay, and then they would step in and offer more money.
Right. Okay. Like, yeah, and eventually, Sub Pop did a deal with Warner Bros., right?
That is correct.
All right. Like, I mean, did you find that hard to do, or was it a case of you needed the money?
We anticipated needing the money. At that time, royalties were coming in from the Nirvana records, so we were doing pretty good. We weren't struggling with bankruptcy every day like we had previously. But we felt that it was a good deal. We only sold 49% of the company, so we maintained control. We held on to 51% and they valued the company at $40 million, which was pretty good considering 2 years previous we were struggling with bankruptcy. So,
so Pop was signing more acts. By 1996, you'd moved on though, hadn't you? By 1996, you decided to do something else.
Yeah, 97 is more like it, yeah. I felt that as the company was growing and getting larger, it was becoming more bureaucratic, and there was pressure, not necessarily from Warner, but from others in the label to mimic major labels and, again, compete with these bids. And my theory is, look, if there's a bidding war for a band, walk away. Because what indie labels do best is find that genius in the room that nobody else sees. And if they're the key is to find artists that are offbeat enough that the majors are not going to touch them. You know what I mean? So trying to mimic major labels and compete with them was, I think, a foolish strategy, and I was very frustrated. So I moved to a remote island and raised some kids.
Okay, so I'm just like it's curious what you say there about the fact that the effect that the influence of Warner had on the label, you know, made you operate more like a major label. I remember interviewing Alan McGee before from Creation Records, and he said the exact same thing. It drove him potty, the fact that this label he developed suddenly got notions, it got other ideas that he didn't agree with. Did you find it hard letting go of this label that you yourself had kind of husbanded and brought into being?
Well, of course, you know, I'd brought it up from its inception. It was pretty heartbreaking decision, but I, as a personality type, I'm kind of a free thinker. I do not work well with bureaucracy. I'm very excited to be working with this new company, 8STEM. It's a small staff. If somebody's got a creative idea, it's usually implemented like 5 minutes later. It doesn't sit in committee for 3 months. So that's the kind of environment that I feel most productive.
And I mean, obviously since Sub Pop, besides 8STEM, you've also been involved in kind of like, I mean, you've published a couple of books.
Yes.
You've been involved in publishing. Have you ever been tempted to go back into record labels again, please?
Well, 8STEM is almost like it's a unique business, but in some ways it does mimic record labels. For example, there's a curation process, so I'm bringing in acts just as I did at Sub Pop. So I'm inspired when I'm working with creative people. And 8STEM, it's a unique interactive music format. Bands, submit their material, and then it gets sent out for remixing. But there is a curation process that's very similar to a record label.
Last question for me, Bruce, and thank you so much for your time as well today. Last question for me. I mean, obviously, since you've left, Sub Pop has continued as a label. It's had a couple of waves and troughs, and there's been some successful acts like Fleet Foxes and The Shins. You know, do you still maintain a fondness for Sub Pop? And what acts have they signed that you've actually went, you know what, I'd like to work with them?
Well, I was just reflecting the other day that there's an industrial hip-hop act from L.A. called Clipping that they signed, and they just posted a video for a song called Shooter. And I love the video. I thought it was extremely creative. You could tell it wasn't high budget, but it was innovative, it was creative, it was resourceful, and I thought it was awesome. I think Sub Pop at this point in time has kind of gone back to its roots as far as signing scrappy young bands that are doing interesting things, and I think it's doing very well.
Bruce, thank you very much for your time. Enjoy the rest of your stay in Lisbon as well. Bruce Pavlin, everybody.
Thank you so much, Tim.
Many thanks to Bruce for joining us at Banter, and thanks to Dara, Eleanor, Catherine, James, Kira and Richard at Web Summit, and obrigado to local crew Josh, Caesar and Ricardo for all their help with Banter in Lisbon. This podcast was produced by Banter series producer Tanya White. Be sure to check out the other podcasts from Banter at Web Summit, and check thisisbanter.com for news of what we're up to. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you again real soon.